Facebook, Google, all of these companies are trying to figure out where are the rules and where are they going to draw the line.
There's clearly a demand for renters. They've got most of them full.
If you own a bond in your retirement portfolio, the price of that is going to go down.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, 720 WGN.
And here we are at 1211 in the Allstate Skyline Studio. Steve Bertrand here. Thanks very much for joining us on the Wintrust Business Lunch. You heard Bill Geiger's voice there. We'll talk to Bill a little bit later about building a retirement income. Dennis Rodkin comes by from Crane Chicago Business. I love it when Dennis is here, and he'll spend the whole second half hour talking about the housing industry and that Al Capone house that is actually up for sale. But we start on Thursdays when we're lucky with Ian Schur, a senior editor from CNET magazine and CNET.com, I should say. He's on the phone line now. Ian, welcome back to the Biz Lunch. How was your week?
It was good. How are you? Is yours?
I'm fine, thank you. And so I'm reading in Crane Chicago Business, actually, about this Amazon story and how Chicago may have been a winner today, right? Because Amazon says they're going to withdraw their plans from New York, and instead those 25,000 jobs they're going to distribute to their hubs around the country. Chicago's one of those hubs.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how Amazon deals with this. You know, they got a lot of criticism for having this kind of American Idol style contest among cities to see who was going to give them the best incentive package, right? And it was, you know, among them, they got $3 billion in incentives to go to New York. And there was a lot of backlash, right? There's increasing backlash all over the country over these incentive packages. You may remember Foxconn in Wisconsin is also costing Wisconsin taxpayers something like $250,000 per job created.
Well, we know that, Ian, we know that well here. I don't know if you know the geography, but that Foxconn is almost in the Chicago metro area. It's just over the border. So there'll be a lot of Illinois workers who could be working there, yeah.
Yeah, so it's there's a lot of this criticism that's happening of these incentive packages to get companies to build. And it's not surprising that Amazon decided they were kind of done fighting with New York, right? So there's a benefit definitely to moving those 25,000 jobs around the campuses around the country. And certainly one of the things that we've learned is that Amazon, in this process of building a second headquarters outside of Seattle, said, look, we can't just have everyone living in Silicon Valley and Seattle. That's not reasonable. We need to be closer to our customers, which means people like Chicago and Texas and D.C. So it'll be interesting to see how this how things change over time.
I wonder, too, with the impact on future sort of development. You mentioned Foxconn, but, you know, because the higher-ups in New York government were all on board. It was the over-unders, you know, some of the more progressive members who were fighting this. It was a more local fight, I guess I should say, than a statewide fight.
I think that the question's going to come down to the math, right? Are these cities, when they are making these proposals to these companies, giving away the farm, right? We are talking about a time when city governments, state governments, and federal government are in increasing debt. And if they are giving away all these tax benefits to companies and they won't get, you know, they won't make the money back for two or three decades, there's a lot of question about whether or not this is worth it. And I think you're starting to see the beginnings of pushback around these ideas.
Oh, one other question about this then. I just wonder if there wasn't a viable alternative, because if they needed New York, they weren't going to just expand in their hubs around the country. They were invested in relocating to New York. Why is it you think that they didn't go to the next city on the list and rather just decided to chuck it all together? That seems a little hinky to me.
I think it's because of this pushback. I think that
they just didn't want to do the fight again.
Yeah, I don't think they want to go through the fight again. They realized that the uproar, I don't think they were expecting the uproar. I think they were expecting to be kind of coming down from the mountain, everyone praising them and saying, thank you for bringing jobs into our city. And I think they were rather shocked by the response instead. And I think that now we're going to start seeing at least Amazon, but definitely other companies, recalibrate about how they handle these things.
Okay, so let's move on then. Was it AT&T that got in trouble because they were sort of advertising they had a form of 5G, but they really don't? And was that AT&T?
It was, yes. Yeah. They put, it says 5GE, which is not 5G. It's right. Actually 4G. And in fact, they got sued over it already. They haven't even really put it out yet. So there's a lot of criticism of them.
The E stand for evolving, right? It's like 5G, right. 5G eventually, something like that. But you guys are running a story, though, about how, especially in densely populated areas, the big phone companies are working toward creating the infrastructure for 5G, and we might already be noticing an impact.
Yeah, so the 5G is more than just another G, right? It's actually supposed to make much faster internet connections for our phones and make them much more reliable. And as the companies are preparing to start this wireless technology, they are actually building into all of the base stations and internet connections in our cities, making them much better. And it turns out that there's research out there from one analyst, Root Metrics, that shows that we're actually all benefiting already because the companies are bolstering the networks they have now in preparation, which I think is really great. And it shows that, you know, that people who don't even buy the latest and greatest phone next year that has 5G, they're at least going to benefit from these changes regardless because there's a ton of investment going on behind the scenes.
Okay, but there is some of these companies have unveiled 5G when it comes to wired houses, correct? We're just talking about mobile phones.
Yes.
Okay.
All right, and that's the thing, right? So 5G eventually, if AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, and T-Mobile get their way, we're going to get rid of all of our modems that we have in our homes right now, and they're all going to be wireless. And it's hard to believe that that's possible, but it turns out that in a lot of places, including, by the way, here in San Francisco, where our internet connections are actually somewhat terrible, wireless could actually be... Yeah, I know, right? The middle of Silicon Valley. Who would have thought? So the wireless connections could actually be more reliable and better. So it's going to be interesting to see how these things change. The idea of moving to an entirely wireless world is rather amazing. It's going to be really interesting.
One more. When I was promoting the show, I said that we were going to talk about the fact how big tech is pushing for DACA. And we've only got about 30, 35 seconds or so. But tell me about that. You know, there's this new bill that's coming through that the governor or president's expected to sign once Congress approves it. It doesn't have DACA protections, but Google, right. Amazon, Apple, and others are really pushing for that. Tell me why.
Well, they actually have employees who are affected by DACA. And look, we're starting to see that the tech industry is broadly much more willing to get involved in politics. And it's really interesting to watch these companies not just make issues around regulation and technology and security, but they're actually pushing on social issues. And we'll see whether this causes a backlash eventually. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But they are definitely stepping up their voice in this conversation.
Ian Schur is a senior editor at CNET.com. Ian, great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Take care.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. For this one's for Bill Geiger right here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on Chicago's very own 720 WGN. Bill Geiger is in the studio, and our conversations with Bill are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. And I learned during the commercial break there that, well, of the two men in the room, Bill is the romantic.
Well, let me just start this off by saying happy Valentine's Day to my beautiful wife, Maite.
There you go.
How's that?
Right. And I said, do you have anything planned? And you go, well, I have lots of stuff planned.
Exactly.
Good for you. Well,
exactly.
I tell her I said happy Valentine's Day as well.
I will do that.
So we're here to talk about retirement and income and being prepared and things like that. We come by every Thursday. What's the one thing you absolutely have to get right before it's time to retire?
Steve, we were talking about...
You have to find the perfect Valentine, but we've...
Hopefully you've done that already.
Okay, we've got this good.
But the other thing you have to do, and I'd like to preface this answer with just a statement, is it's got to be 95% of our listeners out there, their bills in retirement are going to be bigger than their Social Security. In other words, there's going to have more money going out each month than what's coming in for Social Security. So the thing you really have to get right going into retirement, the number one thing, is to have created dependable and sustainable income that's going to replace your paycheck, that's going to make up that difference between Social Security and your bills. And that's probably the one thing you really have to get right.
We talk about this almost every week, right? It's the difference between having a pile of money that you pick from when you need, or having a pile of money that's actually sending you money every month.
Well, if you have a pile of money that you're picking from, you could possibly run out at some point. If you've got a pile of money that's sending you income, that's going to allow you to sleep at night. You're going to be able to live the life that you want to in retirement.
How do you create that? How do you create that money coming in?
Well, late 50s, early 60s, you take a portion of your portfolio and you create an income strategy. You take some of it out of growth. And Steve, it's amazing how many portfolios we see that are 90, 95% growth. You take some of that money and you create an income strategy. And there's a number of different ones that we work with. But you dedicate that new portion of your portfolio to creating dependable, sustainable income that you can count on to supplement your Social Security so you can live well.
I think if you don't get assistance, you think, well, I'm 55 years old. I need to save for the next 40 years, right? I could live till I'm 95 years old. So you don't want to, you think that you need to keep going full bore with an aggressive portfolio to get there. And that could be very risky.
Oh, extremely risky. You have a big loss in your late 50s. Your retirement plans are going to change. We've talked about this before. You're either going to have to work longer if you can. And who wants to do that?
Right, right.
Or you're going to be counting pennies for the rest of your life. And who wants to do that? Yeah, you need to have an income strategy. You need to have control over the risk in your portfolio.
It's Valentine's Day, and what a great Valentine's Day gift this would be, Bill, to get your income, your retirement plan put together. Who's the drivers when it comes into your office? Is it the husbands or the wives?
Well, at the end of the day, it's our wives, right?
Yeah, right.
At the end of the day, it's our wives. And traditionally, wives have done a lot in terms of running a household, in terms of paying the bills. And their biggest concern is when their husband stops working, where's that money going to come from?
Because they're the ones knowing what's going out of the household, what's being out of the household.
Yeah. They do, yeah. Steve, the big questions you have to ask yourself as you're getting ready for retirement is, are you doing everything that you should be doing or everything that you could be doing to get ready for retirement? Do you have an income strategy that you know how you're going to do this? Do you really know how much risk you have? And do you know if you'll have enough money to retire and not run out of money? We can help answer these questions for the next five callers who have at least $500,000 in their portfolio, and we'll do it on a complimentary basis.
Bill Geiger, thanks for coming by. Have a great evening this evening.
Thank you, sir. You too.
Are you confident that you're doing everything you can, everything you should be doing, really, to prepare for retirement? Well, Bill Geiger and his team at Geiger Wealth can help you with those questions. They've got a special opportunity for you today. They're going to sit down with you personally to create a full-blown plan for your retirement. This is up to a $3,000 value, and it's complimentary for the first five callers who have at least $500,000 saved for their retirement. Call 800-681-2498. That's 800-681-2498. At this stage of your life, you probably have more money than you've ever had before, and the last thing you need now is a big loss. Together with you, Bill and his team are going to translate the complex financial planning process into easy-to-understand steps with a personalized, full-blown retirement plan. It's designed to help you retire with confidence. Call Geiger Wealth right now for your complimentary, personalized, full-blown retirement plan. That's 800-681-2498. I'm going to give you that number again, 800-681-2498. It's 12:37. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand here. The program brought to you by Wintrust Chicago's Bank, and we thank them for that. Dennis Rodkin is in the studio, writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business. Dennis, welcome back.
Hi, Steve.
Okay, so, you know, we talked about the whole Amazon development and how the worries here was that it was going to create a rent to skyrocket and all of that. And apparently that was some of the concern in New York. Were you surprised by this news that they're not going to develop their half of HQ2, or is it HQ2.5
or something? Yeah, who knows? You know, I think what I'm surprised about is that this pullout happened so soon after the announcement, because you know that in choosing those two cities, Washington and New York, that process involved a ton of research by people at Amazon and probably lots of consultants. And you would think they anticipated any kind of backlash that was coming. Maybe they underestimated the backlash, or maybe they underestimated their own response to the backlash. I'm just really surprised that so quickly the deal unwinds.
It's interesting because Bezos certainly has shown he's got a stomach for a fight.
Yeah, exactly.
He has, and so maybe they just figured, to hell with it, we can go somewhere else.
I wonder. It's fascinating. Or somebody decided, yeah, it's just really not going to work to have two locations. I don't know. I find it fascinating that it turns around so quickly.
All right, you got a piece at ChicagoBusiness.com about housing inventory and how it's harder ever to buy a house here. It's the lowest inventory in 12 years, right?
In at least 12 years,
which is interesting to me because they only started keeping track of this 12 years ago.
I think the Chicago,
or this particular gauge.
Yeah, I think the Chicago Association of Realtors was keeping the data previously, but they now have it in a digitized way that goes back to, you know, remember the internet was young at that time.
Right.
So their tracking goes back to January 2007,
okay,
which is 12 years plus a little bit, and the number of houses for sale in the city of Chicago, don't have suburban data, is the lowest it's been at any time. It's always low in January, and every January for the past couple of years, it has stepped down a little bit from the one before. Right now, or at the beginning of February, there were just over 3,000 houses for sale. If you go back about 10 years, again, this is single-family homes, there would have been like 8,000 for sale.
Okay, and one of the reasons you list is the property taxes.
Yeah.
And you have an interesting logic here, because when I hear that as a guy who lives in the suburbs and mm-hmm. I look at what city people pay for property taxes, it's not close, right? I mean, suburbanites pay way more for property taxes.
Although
than
most city homeowners will tell you that they pay more. Yes, it's not true. Yeah.
And so when I hear that argument, I'm like, are you kidding me? You know, your burden isn't quite what your brethren across the border are. But your point is that keeps them maybe from buying up.
Yeah, I don't want to. So we know that property taxes have gone up quite a bit in the last several years in Chicago. It appears very likely that they will continue to go up because the pension problem isn't fixed and there are other things that Chicago needs to do. And so let's say I'm in a house worth $100 and my property tax is $5. Do I want to go to a house worth $150 where my property tax is $750?
Right.
When it might go beyond 750, it might go to 8, 9. I don't know.
The other thing is that there are so few houses on the market that a lot of them are being sold before they get to the market.
Yeah. Well, yes. This has been going on for a couple of years. Buyers or people who are looking to buy often connect with agents who have sort of prospected a neighborhood. Here's an older person who has been looking forward to selling but doesn't have it on the market yet. Various other
reasons.
Are
those cards I get in the mail, like we want to buy your house?
Yeah, well, yeah. Yes, that's okay. One of the ways. But some agents are more sophisticated than that, and they know, you know, if for the right number, this couple would sell their house, and here is an area where there have been a bunch of sales, and those older people just haven't refitted their house for sale yet, and that sort of thing. So a lot of buyers, a lot of agents present themselves to buyers as having this kind of inventory available without it ever going on the market.
There was a time 10 or 15 years ago when those cards would come to me, and what they really were saying was, we want to tear down your house.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't think that's the case as much anymore. But okay, we've also talked in the show about rent control and the move into, there are a couple of referenda in some of the wards this that did very well. And now there's a bill introduced that would, it wouldn't lift it statewide, the ban on rent control, or it would create 6 or 7 different districts in the state. Explain this.
Yeah, so it's the most comprehensive. There have been a series of bills presented in Springfield over the past couple of years. This is the one that goes the farthest. It would, first of all, as you know, rent control is prohibited in any municipality in Illinois by Illinois state law from 1997.
Yeah, it's so, not that old of a law, 20
right,
years. Or
a little over 20 years. And this would lift it. Some of the other pieces of legislation would lift it. That's the first step toward allowing rent control in Chicago or any other municipality in Illinois. But what this legislation does is go beyond that to dividing Illinois up into 6 rent control regions, each with an elected board, a 7-member elected board that would govern the percent in one region. It might be that rents can go up 2% this year, but in another region, they might go up 1% based on local factors. Let's just say Effingham has a very different rental market than Chicago does.
But they would pay for themselves by charging renters a fee.
That's one of the
So in other words, for me to keep my rent down, I've got to pay a fee to the government.
Well, yeah, that's how the real estate business sees it. This is a proposal, hasn't yet made it all the way through the legislative process, but as proposed, Landlords would be charged a rent control registration fee. They would be able to pass that along to the renter. And supposedly, these rent control registration fees would fund the rent control board, as well as other things like tax incentives for small landlords to improve their property. So the idea at the moment is that this would be self-funding. There would not be new taxation that would be necessary to have not only rent control, but these rent control boards.
And the argument is that, and that fee would be an annual fee, and would be dwarfed by the savings you would get by having your rent controlled.
That's the theory on the side of the people who are promoting this legislation. On the other side is the idea that you're paying to keep your housing affordable, and also that this would probably turn into another state-funded bureaucracy.
Dennis Rodkin writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, he's going to walk us through Al Capone's old house. Actually, with his ma, his Al Capone's ma's old house. But right now, this.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Chicago Inno is always covering the best Chicago startup news, and they recently shared details from the Interactive Advertising Bureau's 250 Brands to Watch list. And on that list, would you look at that, a number of Chicago companies. Just to name a few are Bucket Feet, the shoe company, Home Chef, the meal delivery service, and much more. They shared them all at ChicagoInno.com, so check them out. And a young gun company that might be finding its way onto one of those lists soon is Second Kitchen. They take bars and businesses that don't serve food, partner with nearby restaurants to provide a number of menu offerings, and get them customers in no time. They also just raised $1.35 million. This idea could really surge the consumer market because not everyone can get those kind of business permits, and the process can be long if you can. So keep an eye out to see if you're seeing these second kitchens more at breweries, smoke lounges, bowling alleys, and more. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
It's 12:52. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank, here on 720 WGN. Dennis Rodkin is here, and he's enjoying all the love songs we're playing for him today. Oh, speaking of love songs, true love, Al Capone, who lived with his wife, his sister, and his mom, right?
Right.
On the South Side.
And I believe a younger brother as well.
72nd. I started to read a biography of him, and I think I read a lot about this house. I didn't finish it, but he dies in the end, I'm pretty sure.
I think he did, yeah.
72nd and Prairie. Tell me about this house, and it sounds like you can buy it for a steal.
$109.9
at this point. Steal, I didn't mean that. Yeah.
Don't, I'm sorry, let's not gang up on Dennis.
Okay, thank you very much.
$109.9. It was recently foreclosed. It's actually being sold by a foreclosing lender, not through the Capone family. I mean, Capone's family hasn't owned it since the 1970s, but they owned it from the 1920s to the 1970s, at 1923 to 1972. The names on the deed, the signatures on the deed, are Capone's wife and mother.
Mm-hmm.
And what was fascinating to me, which is in the story, is you know, Capone was sort of a kind of a celebrity, but in a dark way. And so there are all these articles in the Tribune where reporters are visiting his house when he's in jail. They're talking to his mom and his sister, and his sister has the flu, and they go sit in her bed. The reporters go sit in her bedroom and describe her nightgown and her curtains and that
Wow.
sort of thing, as you would if you were interviewing some movie star
Right.
in her hotel suite. So the family owned it from the 20s through the 70s. He didn't live there. From the time he went to jail, he appears not to have lived in Chicago again. Moved to already had a home in Miami, but moved full-time there. His mother was there until she died.
Wow. And so I love, too, that the story is that there's a tunnel from the basement to the garage.
Right.
If every tunnel story about Al Capone was true, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's all you hear about tunnel stories of Al Capone. Okay. So from that home, $109,000, which may or may not go, let's go to the Warring Condos. And there's now this guy behind Vivid Seats, Eric Vassilatos.
Eric Vassilatos.
Just bought how many condos? Five condos?
Six.
Six condos
at the Water Tower on three different floors.
Okay.
They're contiguous, but it's two condos on the top floor, one on the next, and three on the bottom. So you got to figure out how.
Think about that next time you're buying White Sox tickets through Vivid Seats.
Yeah, because the total investment is a minimum of $15 million. He's spent about $7.5 million buying the condos. and he took out a perm. That's over the course of a few years. He bought them. He didn't buy them all at once. And then last week took out a permit, a construction permit that says that combining them into one will bring it up to about $15 million. And that's generally the minimum, because when you file a construction permit, you're not saying how much you're going to pay on wallpaper or cabinets or that sort of thing. It's really for the
right.
the heavy construction, the code, the things that are
so the cherry cabinets aren't included in this.
The cherry cabinets, Steve, I swear.
We'll never let that go. Okay, so I went to the Marquette DePaul game this week, and I was buying tickets, and I ended up on Vivid Seats. And, I don't buy resale very often, or I just don't. But I'm looking, and, like, there's floor seats here. They're not on the floor, but the first row back. And it's like, well, it's $86. $86. I'm right across from the Marquette bench. This could be kind of fun. I'm going to go with a buddy. Like, I'll swing for that. $165, right? $170 for two seats. I mean, a lot of money, but I'll do it. And then I checked out, and my bill was like $220.
Oh, wow.
These fees, and I just did not check closely enough. But anyway,
so now we know why he can afford a $15 million
Eric's name was on my ticket.
Was actually on the ticket.
It was on the ticket. So I bought one of the poles for his new cabinet.
That's probably true, for his cherry cabinets.
Another thing you wrote about in the minute we have left was this Supreme Court ruling that impacts condo associations and their ability to sue. And you write that it's very significant. Explain for me why it's a big deal.
It is. For about 35 years, lawyers for condo associations could pursue damages, could pursue the funding on construction defects by going after subcontractors. We don't have time to explain exactly why, but subcontractors don't have a signed contract with the homeowner. But the developer does. A developer generally uses a limited liability company, goes out of business. So the question for about 35 years, the doctrine was that there was an implied warranty with the subcontractor.
So you could go after the subcontractor if the work was bad.
For some of these high rises, you're talking $2, $3 million if the facade is failing, if the parking garage is leaking, that sort of thing. And in December, there was an Illinois Supreme Court decision that took away that doctrine that there is an implied warranty that passes from the homeowner through the developer, through the contractor, to the subcontractor. That's gone.
Which is a big deal. Maybe legislation could fix that?
Some of the attorneys I spoke to said that there may actually be a move to try and reverse that reversal.
Read more about that at chicagobusiness.com. Dennis Crane, Dennis Rodkin, great to see you.
Thanks, Steve.
See, it's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.